Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Project MedTech. I'm your host, Dwayne Mancini. If you enjoy this podcast, please do us a favor, subscribe, leave a review, and share on your network. As always, if you need to get a hold of the podcast for any reason, whether it be to get connected with a previous guest, recommend a future guest, or take advantage of our network, please email us at projectmedtechpodcast@gmail.com. My guests today are Bhavana Mohanraj and Mike Dishowitz. Bhavana has a bachelor's, a master's, and a PhD in biomedical engineering and is the assistant director at PCI Ventures. Mike has a bachelor's in mathematics and also a PhD in biomedical engineering, and Mike is the associate director of PCI Ventures. In today's episode, Mike, Bhavana, and I discuss PCI Ventures, the history of it, and what they are doing at the University of Penn. So without further ado, my discussion with Bhavana and Mike.
Medical innovation starts with medical discussion. Talking about the future and what comes next with Project MedTech.
Okay, Mike, Bhavana, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's great to be here.
Yeah. So as I mentioned in both your bios, you're part of PCI Ventures. Before we get to that, let's maybe just, we'll start with Bhavana and then we'll move to Mike. Maybe just talk about your background, how you got to where you are, and then we'll really dive into what you guys are doing with PCI Ventures.
So Mike and I have very similar backgrounds, and I'll let Mike do his bit, but we both went to Penn, did our PhD in the bioengineering department. In particular, I worked with the orthopedic surgeons and clinicians developing tissue engineered strategies for regenerating cartilage. It was a great 5 years that I spent at Penn, but I got, you know, the itch to do something different, try something new. So while I was at Penn, actually, I got to work a little bit with Mike, starting a company around the research I was doing for my thesis, developing a drug delivery system to repair orthopedic tissues. And that was a good launching point for me to join a small medical device company up in Connecticut called BioRes. And they're developing regenerative implants to treat and repair or heal tendons and ligaments in the body for sports medicine applications. And so I joined them in 2017 as the director of R&D. And that was a very eye-opening experience coming from an academic research background to a company that's has a very laser focus on developing a product and getting that through the regulatory process and getting clinicians to weigh in and adopt such a product. And so that was a good experience for about a year and a half before I came back to PCI Ventures to work with a number of startups that are coming out of the university.
Okay, great. And Mike?
Yeah, a lot of parallels, as Bob said. So I got my PhD at Penn in bioengineering as well, did orthopedic research. I studied cell signaling pathways and bone regeneration. At the end of my thesis, we were actually involved in creating a new technology. Reached out to the tech transfer office at the time at Penn. It was known as CTT. Now it's known as the Penn Center for Innovation, PCI. Filed a patent on it. And they connected us with a new group that was created at the time that was led by Michael Poizel, who's the director of PCI Ventures. And they said, you know, this seems to, you know, it's got some promise. This is really interesting. Have you ever thought about creating a startup? Never crossed my mind at the time. You know, I was very much heads down, just trying to get through the PhD process. You know, I was already 6 years in, so I was ready to finish up and go. But we said, okay, you know, why not? Let's give it a shot. And I actually ended up really enjoying the work, which I called the black box at the time. You know, we hear we're involved in doing, you know, academic research, publishing papers in different journals or different, you know, articles, Fierce Biotech, other things online. You know, you see all these drugs that are getting approved or big rounds of financing, but what you don't hear about is kind of what happens in between all of that work. And so I really enjoyed doing that for several months while finishing on my PhD and working on this company. Ultimately, the company, you know, I was unsuccessful and the company was unsuccessful, but I, because I was interested in it, I wanted to pivot my career more from R&D to the commercialization side. Knowing that I had no background, what I decided to do was to go into consulting afterwards. So I joined a boutique consulting firm called Pricepective at the time, where we did pricing and market access and asset valuation for the biotech industry. So mostly therapeutics, but also some medical devices. And that gave me the necessary background that it's just not, you can't just have statistical significance in an animal model, and that warrants $1 million investment. There's a lot of other variables that go into the equation. So I was there for a little while before, I always stayed in touch with the folks at PCI Ventures. And they, when they were expanding the team, I talked with them and came back and joined the group 6.5 years ago now. And currently I'm the associate director of the team. And with Bhavana, we co-manage the life science portfolio.
Okay, great. So you guys deal with anything in the life science space then? Or do you guys specialize in a segment of that?
We specialize in everything that goes on at all the research that goes on at the university. But Bob and myself, we split life science. I mean, I think we each have diagnostics, medical devices, therapeutics, research tools. We sprinkle it around.
Okay, very cool. So let's dive into it. What does PCI Venture stand for? What was it again? You'd briefly had mentioned it.
Mm-hmm. The Penn Center for Innovation Ventures Group.
Great. Okay. And just maybe let's, we understand you're focused on life sciences, but maybe could we talk a little bit about the history? Are there some like flagship companies that have come out of it? Maybe just dive into a little bit of that too.
Sure. Bob, do you want me to take that one?
Sure. You can start. Right. I can add on.
Okay, great. Yeah. So our group has been around for about 10 years. And back when it was started, I refer to us as PCI Ventures, but back when it was started, we were known as Upstart. Upstart is a company formation program where, when faculty have an invention, if they want to start up and if they want to work with us, there's a series of things that we can do to help them. And effectively, we act as a co-founder alongside of them, building the company, recruiting management, sitting on the board, helping to raise financing, helping to develop the strategy of the company, helping with operations, everything that's needed with a co-founder. And it was a model that worked really well for the University of Pennsylvania community. I'd say, most of our flagship companies have come out of that model, but as time went on, there were other types of either faculty or technologies or whatever out there that, didn't need the one size fits all didn't work for them. So we came up with another company formation program, which is a little bit more hands-off. It's really for faculty that, they've got a team in place already, or maybe they have an investor lined up, or maybe the technology isn't quite ready to go raise a round of financing. So they don't need all of those activities that, they don't need another co-founder necessarily. But what they do want to do is to tap into the entire infrastructure and ecosystem that we've developed over the years, the connections with investors, with all that kind of stuff. And so that company formation program is called Up Advisors, where we help, get them connected with everything and everything that we know. And so that's also been a very successful program as well. It was about probably 5-6 years ago where the Tech Transfer Office rebranded from the Center for Technology Transfer to the Penn Center for Innovation. And that's when we became known as the Penn Center for Innovation Ventures Group. For companies, we've had a handful of exits over the past couple of years. One was a therapeutics company that is still under a confidentiality agreement for that one, but a company acquired that asset and was going through clinical trials at the time, or about to go through clinical trials. We had a digital health company that was acquired by a Cardinal Health portfolio company, Right Care Solutions. That technology came out of the nursing school, and what they identified, actually through various means of research, has nothing to do with the disease or the reason why a patient might be presenting at a hospital, but through a series of questions, they'd be able to identify high-risk individuals that would be at risk of being readmitted to the hospital within 30 days or a certain number of days. And, that's a big issue for hospitals and for reimbursement. So That one ended up to be a pretty interesting company and pretty successful. And you know, we might have an opportunity to talk to about it during this podcast. But there are some other companies that are actively going on right now in phase two clinical trials, and another in phase one, and another is waiting for FDA clearance for their product. All of which are, you know, interesting stories that we might get to.
Yeah. Yvonne, anything to add to that?
I think it's been interesting over the last few years to see how these companies have taken the technology out of the lab, and as Mike referred to briefly, are starting to approach the FDA either with their IND or IDE submissions and actually getting this out there on the commercial market. Mm-hmm. So we've had over 200 companies that we've formed over the past 10 years. Right now, our active portfolio is about 70 companies, and I'd say about 2/3 of them are life sciences. So they're making good progress by building the team. They're often really lean startups, I would say. Most of our teams are, you know, the CEO, the founders, sometimes a grad student or a postdoc decides that they want to pursue this full time and they join the team. But they're lean and mean fighting machines, I guess is the right way to put it, to keep developing these technologies into real products.
Yeah, and well, you're hitting on a good point. I mean, a lot of med tech companies, especially startups, are very lean, and so an organization like yourself, that's where they could tap into an already extensive network, is really valuable. So, before we get ahead of ourselves, because I think that's a big point. so these are all companies that spin out of U of Penn, correct? Okay. You know, and I don't, we'll just, I want to touch on Philadelphia for a second here, because I was really impressed. I had never been to Philadelphia before. And in my old job at NAMSA, I had went to University City Science Center and worked with them, but we had also stopped at U of Penn and some other area, you know, some other local places there. And it was just, I didn't realize how big the life science, but even med tech market is there. It's pretty impressive, and the amount of resources that you know people have locally to them is impressive as well. You know, something I always say is like, you know, for a startup company, it doesn't matter where your talent is or where they're geographically located. You have to take advantage of them. But there is something to be said for local, you know, talent that's easy to plug in. And Philadelphia, you know, when you think of like med tech, everyone throws out Boston, they throw out Minneapolis, San Francisco. And then all of a sudden you have this like second tier of some people talk about San Diego, Texas as a state, maybe Houston specifically. Philadelphia is right there. It's really quite impressive what you have guys have going on there. So can you just talk a little bit about that local ecosystem that, you know, if you're a student or you're at Penn and you're going to license the technology and spin a startup, you know, talk about the resources that are local right there that they can take advantage of that you guys have access to and you can plug them into.
So there's
Bob, you know, please can you go ahead with it. Yeah.
So there's a number of, I'd say, local accelerators and consortiums like the University City Science Center that are resources for startups in the area. So there's actually a launch lane accelerator through the University City Science Center that has a program every fall and every spring. NextFab, which is a great makerspace, has multiple locations in Philadelphia, has a rapid hardware accelerator program. Between the Pennovation Center, which has our team as a resource, and the University City Science Center as a whole, I think there's a lot of expertise. We hold programming events, office hours with regulatory consultants, reimbursement consultants, other services that each company needs, finances, accounting, lawyers. It's all, I think, here and really supportive of the startup ecosystem. They want these small companies to grow. And so they're willing to offer their services in a way that's affordable and amenable to a startup that has very few resources to begin with.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I'd just like to add my perspective over the 15 years I've been here. So I moved to Philadelphia in 2006 to start graduate school. And, you know, at that time and pretty much all throughout grad school, there was no talk about entrepreneurship, at least on the life science side. And you know, no sort of culture or community around that I was aware of at the time. In part, you know, Michael Paisel, the director of our group, he was hired 10 or 11 years ago because, yeah, again, you know, they were like, oh, startups, I think I've heard a little bit about that in Boston, or it's, you know, what's going on at Penn? And, you know, and he was hired to really build this out. And, you know, Bob talked about the number of companies we've created, so you could see how much the changes have happened. But, you know, one thing or a couple of things that just have really are indicative of that change and have also driven some of that change is, you know, from our perspective, the university itself. The resources that Penn has put into developing technologies and supporting startup companies. One in particular is the Pennovation Center. You know, they created this incubator, which now there's an incubator called the Pennovation Center, but there's a Pennovation Works campus that has main labs for other companies that graduate. There's office buildings, there's all this stuff. And, you know, this is all open to the public. You don't need to be affiliated with Penn to take residence there. And it doesn't just help out the Penn community, it helps out the Philadelphia community, which helps Penn out. Well, you know, it goes back and forth. The stronger Philly is, the stronger Penn is, and vice versa. Also, several years ago, the university, you know, started to take notice of medical device innovation. Not that they hadn't taken notice beforehand, but they put together a task force to do a, you know, landscape assessment of what's going on at Penn. And a lot of this stemmed from, you know, from a therapeutic perspective or a diagnostic technology perspective. You know, there's academic grants that are available for this kind of molecular discovery work. R1, you do the research, you have, and, you know, potentially come with invention and go from there. But a lot of medical device innovation is more coming from a physician that says, I have this great idea. You know, if I can just get this done or, you know, get a prototype made, I can really, and that's not really academic, that's not funded by academic research for the most part. The NIH doesn't fund too much of that. The NSF doesn't fund too much of that. And the avenue that physicians and also scientists had to get this done was to go to a med tech company and say, hey, here's my idea, let me consult for you. And then they'd give them their ideas and hopefully the company goes with it. But they wanted to play a bigger role, and there are also some ideas that would go nowhere. So what Penn did is with this task force, took a look at what's going on around campus. And there was a lot of ideas that people were having. And we saw it ourselves too, because faculty would come to us with ideas. Hey, let's do this. And it's just the sketch on the napkin, all right? They're like, file a patent on this, sketch on, you know, what are we gonna do with this? Who's gonna license this? How are we gonna raise money around this? You know, and our only avenue at that point was, you know, let's get some SBIR funding, SBIR grants in, hopefully get some of that funding. Those are grants for small businesses funded by NIH, NSF, other departments. And that was successful for some companies, but, you know, it'd be a lot easier to recruit management, to get funding, even to get SBIRs if there was some prototyping funding available. And so what Penn ended up putting together was a new center called the Penn Center for Health Devices and Technology, or Penn Health Tech for short. And, you know, they serve as the center of all medical device work that goes on at the university. You know, when it's time for a startup or if they need some commercialization advice, we're involved. They fund prototyping. They, you know, bring in other people, you know, and we co-sponsor stuff with them. There's work that goes on in the Penn Center for Healthcare Innovation. They have a medical device accelerator that does that funds work, and that also helps with hands-on building. So all of this did not exist in 2006. It didn't exist in 2014 when I, you know, first joined PCI Ventures. You know, it's all been the past couple of years. You know, things have been really growing in the Philly area.
Yeah. Wow. It's impressive too. It's something that, and I'm not going to go on this soapbox, but it's something I wish that Cleveland, I live in Cleveland. We have the Cleveland Clinic. It's fantastic. But at the same time, you know, realizing, I think the public's opinion is, well, we have the Cleveland Clinic, so we must be on the forefront of all things, you know, health innovation. And
I just don't think that's not true, right? We might have a lot of clinical trials here. I might be on the cutting edge of running new technology, but we're not developing it. And those startup companies aren't here, which kind of stinks, but that's neither here nor there. Let's focus on Philly. But no, I think that's really cool. So let's talk a little bit more about PCI Ventures. So how does the program work? Do you guys actually, is there a piece that invests in the company, or is there like a grant, or, you know, maybe talk about a little bit of how the financials work and then how the program works in general, or the number of programs? I don't know.
Bob, do you want to go?
Sure. So we have two programs, as Mike briefly described earlier. So the first one is called Upstart. And so our Upstart model is the one where we're really hands-on with the companies. We're acting as business development co-founders. So our faculty have to really want to do this. We don't chase the faculty or the researchers or clinicians. If they're really excited about an idea, we want to support them as much as we can. Okay. And so through this model, we're right there with them is the best way I can describe it. So we have an equity model where Penn has 49% of the company. The founders have 51% of the company collectively initially. And then when investment comes into the company, when they license the technology from Penn, the founders have to fall below a 50% threshold. And that's in accordance with the Penn patent policy of the university. So what we do in the interim between the founding and them having investment is recruit a CEO. And so Penn will take the dilution for recruiting a CEO or the executive management. We want the founders to retain as much equity as possible. It's important that they feel connected to their company and their technology. And so when we recruit a CEO, we're trying to encourage them to spend their time on a company that doesn't have any financing, doesn't have any funding yet, to do this work. They're going out and spending a lot of time either doing a market assessment, developing a financial plan, a strategy, starting to talk to investors. And we've been really fortunate, I think, in the Philly area to have access to a great pool of talent between the medical device companies that are in Westchester, up near King of Prussia, and media. We have, and a lot of pharmaceutical companies as well, there are executives or high-level people at those companies that are now looking to do their next thing. And so they get really excited about the startups and the technology that's coming out of Penn because they can run with it. They can literally build it from the ground up. And so we've had some really great CEOs that we've been fortunate to work with to help create these companies.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so when you guys, in terms of, like, and this is just another Philly general question, but in terms of raising money in Philly, like for some of these startup companies, obviously, you know, companies can go anywhere and raise money. Like, you know, if you're in the middle of nowhere, Oklahoma, and you have a startup company, you can go places and find money to raise it. But there is something to be said. You know, there's just a lot of companies who are in San Francisco. It's easier to find money if you're in San Francisco versus Cleveland. For Philly, it's interesting, right? So there's obviously some Philly VC groups that I'm aware of personally, but also like the geographically. I mean, you're close to New York, and you're probably somewhat close to Boston, and maybe even like the DC area. So is it, what is like raising money like in Philly for some of these companies? Is it, you know, you start locally and then you expand to some of those areas around you? I mean, there's a lot of VC groups in Boston, New York, like I said, and Philly's like really uniquely fit in between both. Is that right? Or am I off on my geography?
You know what? When it comes to, I guess if you call it either top tier investors or larger rounds of financing, geography doesn't matter too much. But that is because we're lucky enough to work for a university that has a very well-known and good reputation. Yeah. You know, I'm not saying that this would be the case for other academic institutions. But you know, we have connections to investors in Boston, New York, San Francisco, you know, Texas, wherever. That's not too much of an issue, right? If there's if we have a company that's operating in a certain space and, you know, we find an investor that we don't know, you know, if, excuse me, if we reach out to them and say, oh, you know, we work at the University of Pennsylvania, we have some interesting technologies, usually they'll answer our, you know, cold email, and then we'll be able to meet them and potentially facilitate introductions or meetings with the companies. That said, on the smaller scale, relatively speaking, of fundraising, you know, say seed round,
yeah,
100,000, something like that. That's where geography really matters. You know, and there's probably not as much money in Boston, New York, or San Francisco, but, you know, I think the angel community in Philadelphia is fantastic. The angel and related community. So you've got Ben Franklin Technology Partners, which is a state-sponsored VC. They do a lot of early stage investing and provide support to a lot of early stage companies. You know, they're fantastic. Bob and I already talked about one of the accelerators, NextFab. They help with medical device prototyping. They also fund companies as well. Angel groups in particular, you know, there's Mid-Atlantic Diamond Ventures, Robinhood Ventures, Delaware Crossing. There's the Pennsylvania Angel Network. You know, they meet once a month to talk about, you know, ongoing deals. PA, Life Sciences, Bio. Mid-Atlantic Bio. There's a lot, and the, you know, there's a lot of overlap between them, but they're in a good way. It's good to know to all of them. You know, they definitely. I mean, they do a lot of good work. They fund a lot of companies. Sometimes like high tech stuff or stuff that has a long runway is a little bit challenging. And that definitely comes out of university. But, you know, what our job is to do is to know what they're looking for, mm-hmm. and the technologies that we are helping to build into companies, make sure that we show them what they're interested in.
Yeah. No, it's helpful. And I think that's kind of some of the pieces that, you know, I wanted to touch on was because a lot of these companies, a lot of startups, you know, don't get off the ground because it might be hard to find some of that initial funding. And then once you get through that barrier, yeah, then it's if you have something and you're looking for a Series A, right, you know, raise or B or C, VCs are going to find you. It doesn't matter where they are. So yeah, I think that's interesting. That's the kind of insight I was looking for because I wasn't. You know, I kind of knew of it, but not being there, not really. I'm still learning a lot about the Philly area. Yeah.
One thing I can't stress enough, the type of funding that we tap into is the Small Business Innovative Research Grants, SBIR grants, mm-hmm. From the National Institutes of Health, National Science Foundation, other federal agencies as well. You know, you talk about it's very hard to get that first money in, mm-hmm. to a company, very hard to break through. If you've got a really good technology, even if it's early stage, if it's not quite there yet, for investment. If you get one of these grants, that's kind of a stamp of approval from, you know, an academic and commercial community that says this is good, this is worthwhile. And if you can hit some milestones and develop it further, that does get the attention of the people you were probably talking to beforehand, before you decided to go to the SBI firm.
And it's undilutive.
You
know,
that's always great.
Yeah, and that's something we've talked about before on the podcast as well. You know, is when we've talked about, you know, how do you finance a successful startup company? And you know, there's some people who I've seen who are successful, who have just used non-dilutive funding, and that's mm-hmm. really impressive. You know, depending, I think that is very device specific. And I try to tell a lot of people that, you know, most medical devices are a 510K, generally speaking. I mean, just statistically, they're mostly a 510K. I think if you're a 510K device and you try to do all non-dilutive funding, you're going to run into trouble in general. It's just going to take way too long for you to get that product to market. And I see a lot of companies maybe underestimate the time it's going to take for them to achieve true market access once they have approval. And I think by that time, if they've taken too long trying to raise money to get this thing through, they've probably missed their window. But I'm glad you brought that up because I think most companies could probably utilize the non-dilutive and then dilutive fundraise mentality as they go through. The other, you know, before I want to talk about current companies, but I'm going to save that. I save that for a little bit towards the end here. I want to talk about, you guys both work with startup companies a lot. I mean, that's all you guys do. So let's talk about specific to medical device and maybe digital health, telehealth, because that line's probably blurred. What are some of the things, let's start with problems. I'm not being pessimistic, but most people who listen to this, who maybe have a venture, want to know where the hurdles are and where the pitfalls are. So let's talk about that. Maybe, you know, your top, I don't know, just let's talk about some common errors you see with these companies.
I think one of the biggest question marks, even for a technology that's sort of defined what the problem is that they're solving, is verifying that information. So talking to as many potential end users or people who are in the clinical workflow path that will have their hands on their this device at some point is really important up front. I think there's a lot of assumptions that go into the problem that you're solving. And until you actually start talking to the people who are going to use it and hear what they need, not necessarily what they want. And that's a really hard thing to define. Because if you ask someone outright, they may tell you something that doesn't hold true once you've developed a product and no one buys it, right? Mm-hmm. So it needs to be the life-saving drug and not the vitamin. So how do you figure that out? And actually the NSF iCore program does a great job of sort of forcing entrepreneurs and innovators to really do that research. So that's something I would stress up front is talk to 50 clinicians, talk to 100 clinicians or nurses or staff who are going to be interacting and understand who are you designing for? What are you designing for before you even commit the money and resources and time to validating it and verifying the device? I think that's just one thing that always pops into my head.
Yeah, it's great advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to add on top of that, you know, for those that, you know, rightfully identify fund, you know, money is an issue. Any savvy investor is going to want to know that you've already spoken to those 100 individuals or organizations, and they want those answers and the feedback that you've gotten before they would invest in the company. Mm-hmm. You know, another thing to add on to that would also be talent. You know, with medical devices, if you're raising money or getting grants or whatever, usually it's smaller just because of how much it costs to develop a 510K versus something, you know, an NDA, a drug type thing. You know, the rounds are going to be smaller, mm-hmm. Which actually gives you a narrower window for success. You can't make mistakes. You know, if you want to use a contract manufacturing group and if it just doesn't work out, you know, you've spent your money and now you have something that doesn't work the way it needs to work, and that's it. You know, you just, there's nothing left to do. You know, who's going to give you more money to do something after you've been given money to do that and you have to do it again? So you want to make sure to have the right team in place, to know, yeah, that's important for every single industry, but, you know, especially for med tech.
Yeah, it's good to hear. It's good for people to hear that. I mean, it's always nice when I ask this question of most guests, and I haven't heard something new in a long time, and that's a good thing, right? It's a good thing and a bad thing. It means people are still making the same mistakes, but it's a good thing in terms of really driving home the point of these are the things, you know, especially as a CEO, and a lot of times that's a big transition, right? I mean, so. All three of us on here are scientists, right, by training. I don't have a PhD, but I have a master's. And I think transitioning from, you know, the scientist, like developer mindset to now you're the CEO of this company, maybe, if that's something you want to do. Transitioning out of that and thinking about things like this that normally, I mean, as a scientist, I never thought about, right? I never thought about leadership or building a team or doing these types of things, but it's things you're going to have to do. And it might be difficult to sometimes do that. And so this kind of advice is really good for them to hear, because if they don't do it, they're not going to be successful and they're not going to find money. Right. So we talk about that next step, right? You get through maybe some non-dilutive funding, you get through maybe some angel funding. Now you're going for, you have a clinical trial and you got to raise $8 million to get to the next step, you're going to go find VC family office money. They are not going to invest in you if they don't believe in that team. Mm-hmm. And so that's an important and really important point. I'm glad you made it. Are there other problems that you guys want to touch on? I mean, I don't know if you have a larger list. I'm sure you probably do, but anything else that's you want to talk about?
Yeah, I'd say being in this job for 6 years and just this organization being around for 10 years, we haven't seen it all. Mm-hmm. But we've seen a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not everything, obviously, we can talk about.
Yeah.
But, you know, you talk about the team. We have companies, you know, we have companies that can, you know, they're killing it. They're doing great. They are, you know, developing an amazing product. They're selling things. And I mean, they either can't get along or there's egos and there's all, and you know, you see whether the press releases that are coming out and this company's killing it. And then when you look on the inside, you're like, oh, they're hanging on by a thread. And I actually think that's more normal than it is not. I mean, mm-hmm. interpersonal skills or interpersonal relationships are so important. So, you know, you hiring the wrong person, hiring the wrong CEO, right? Whether they're not successful or just, you know, there are interpersonal issues there, that sets you back more time than you realize. First, you have to hire them. Then you need to realize that they're not the right person. Then you need to take some time to get rid of them. Then you need to regroup. And by then, you know, time has gone by, and if there's competition, it could be over.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Mike, and let's talk about that real quick. I've brought this up before in the past, but I haven't talked about it for a number of episodes. So you just talked about that, right? And then all of a sudden your timeline got longer. So there's data out there. NAMSA was one of them. And when I worked there, you know, we had this program and Covance can do the same thing, but, what we had, like, you know, it's getting to market as quick as possible, right? Because you want to raise as little money as possible so you don't lose equity in your company. And this is something, like you were talking about, the increased timeline that we saw happen is, you know, the longer it takes for you to get to market, the less equity you have in your company. And what we were seeing was we would see these companies who had these, what appeared to be on the surface, awesome exits. And then you talk to the founders and the CEO and the executive team, and really they barely made any money off it, right? They made enough to pay the time they put in, but that was it. They really didn't get the payoff that they were hoping because they made those mistakes. You talked about the manufacturing, you know, contract manufacturing. You talk about finding maybe a executive clinical lead who doesn't actually work out, and then you waste a whole year, and you know, you wasted 2020. Then all of a sudden, you know, you talk to them and they really didn't do that well because they barely owned any other company at that point. So you're right. I never thought about it from a team perspective like that, where I always look at it as, because my background's in regulatory and clinical and reimbursement. And if you make those mistakes, I say, well, if you work with the wrong person here, that's really going to hurt. But yeah, you're right. You make a wrong choice with a CEO or a VP of something. It could be that's a year. It just dawned on me now. I mean, that could be a full year until you onboard them, realize they're bad, and exit them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there are many opportunities to make bad decisions during the startup life cycle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not just the CEO obviously is incredibly important, but it's other, you know, say you have a great CEO, they raise money, you hire somebody, and then that lead technician, you know, is not working out. Right. I mean, that could be all of your money right there that goes to that. And how can you even recover from that? So yeah. Hiring is important, very important.
Yep. Bhavana, did you have anything to add?
I guess I was going to say from the Penn perspective, I said that we have really lean companies that, mm-hmm. You know, are in these early stages. They've got maybe two or three, four people on the team initially. One of the great things about Penn is being able to leverage some of the resources internally so you don't have to grow the team so quickly to cover, let's say, like, looking at your IP. If you need to do a freedom to operate or you need to look at patentability, we have a Detkin IP law clinic within Penn that our companies have access to be able to get that expertise with law students. We have programs with Wharton that do consulting projects to look at pricing, financial projections, access, market landscape. And that is hard for any one person to do by themselves. And so to be able to use these resources and have students that are enthusiastic and committed to helping these companies goes a long way to being able to build the story that the companies then go out and use to fundraise and actually move forward.
Yeah. And there's a lot of people out there who are fractionalizing some of these positions that are important to a med tech company. And I think, you know, what you just said fits into everything I preach to companies, whether it be on the podcast or when I'm talking to them through Covance, if they're a startup company. And that's, you know, if you can keep your capital burn rate down and have someone you can turn off and on, but get the same value, you should take advantage of it. There's plenty of people out there who could be your regulatory person that don't need to be a full-time employee. There's plenty of people who could be your clinical arm who don't need to be a full-time employee. Same with reimbursement, same with accounting, like CFO. People are fractionalizing CFO services. People are fractionalizing product development and engineering. And maybe that's something you bring on, but I think it's really important and something that maybe people underestimate. And I'm not saying that there's no point which you'd want these people on your team full time. And people have done it that way as well. I'm not saying this way is right, but just I've seen a lot of companies do it successfully where they outsource a lot of that and have consultants and really focus internally on engineering. But even you could probably outsource that to a certain extent. But really, one thing that I really think companies should focus on from the very beginning, and if you're going to make one big full-time choice, it's on commercialization. Because I think that is just by far the biggest place where I see people underestimate. You know, even you get through regulatory approval, you're reimbursable, your clinical trial goes great. And then all of a sudden you're like, okay, now I got to sell this thing. And now you're going to bring someone on. That person should have been in place years ago because it takes a while to get into hospital systems, to get into doctor's offices, to sell on a regional market. And depending on your exit plan, if your exit plan is, hey, I want to be acquired. Well, they're going to tell you, I mean, any strategic, any private equity group is going to tell you, you better be able to sell this on a regional market. And I think people underestimate how hard that is. So I don't know how you guys feel about that, but I think commercialization is it, like the commercial strategy of it and selling it and being on the market is something I see often overlooked.
Yeah, we see it too. I would, you know, especially from MedTech, it's the hope still is, let's get this approved. Let's sell this, right? You know, once it's approved, we can sell it. And that might work for some companies that are in the pipeline, but most of them, no, not at all. And we do have some, one company in particular, Quantitative Radiology Solutions, they just, filed for their FDA clearance recently. They're gearing up to start selling once they get that. They know what they need to do to get to the next step. Because they've done what Bob and I already talked about is they've talked to the customers. What do you want? What do you need? I mean, they've talked to them multiple times. The first one was, what do you want from a technology perspective? Okay, great. You know, we know how to develop that. What do you want from, from a business perspective? Okay, revenue, up to all of that stuff. So, you know, we see a mixed bag. And now, you know, obviously our advice is always, you know, go be prepared for the next step, right? If you happen to get acquired and you've got somebody on your team that is not needed anymore, that's great. You got acquired if that was what you were going for. That's a success. You always want to be prepared to keep going, right? If you want, sometimes you have to raise that next round because no one's there to buy you right now. You raise it and then they acquire you. That's fine. You know, it was ultimately successful. There's a product. It's helping people.
Yep.
If you know, being acquired was your goal, you achieve that.
Yeah. No, I think that's really helpful. And none of this is to scare away people from innovating, right? It's just, these are where you fail. This is how you could prevent that. So let's talk about industry trends. You guys are obviously on the forefront of a lot of innovation at University of Penn. So maybe talk about where you see the industry going. And like I said, this could be med tech, digital health, telehealth. It's all kind of the same. So maybe start there.
I think one of the things I've noticed, at least in my portfolio, is that there are more companies developing technologies related to decision or risk analysis for clinicians. So they're not necessarily diagnostics in the traditional sense, but they're tools that will help clinicians make decisions either more objectively using evidence so that you're treating patients in the appropriate and, from the hospital perspective, cost-effective ways of managing treatment. And so I have several companies in my portfolio that do that for on the therapeutics side, on the detection of disease side. And I think that's been really interesting to see over the last year and a half, almost 2 years that I've been with the team.
And to comment on that, what a smart regulatory play that is, because it takes you from a software as a medical device to not regulate it as a medical device. So it's nice from a regulatory standpoint. But that's really cool. That's something I've been seeing a little bit too with some companies I've been working with. Mike, what about you?
From a telehealth, digital health perspective, the types of innovations we work with are usually based on research. QRS, the one company I talked about, it's a software, but it's an algorithm that's been in an AI algorithm that's been in development for 30 years, that kind of stuff. A lot of telehealth stuff is, I've got this great idea, let's get the code made, let's create the front end, the back end, and do all that stuff. We help advise some of that stuff, but usually that's not invented by a faculty member in Penn. Regardless, we're still seeing that, on the telehealth and digital health side, a lot of it is about hospital efficiency, seeing patients or how to, and the efficiency could be for cost saving measures, or it could be for safety measures, or it could be for, other efficacy measures. But it's everything is focused on making hospital treatment better. And the group at Penn that spearheads a lot of this work is the Penn Center for Healthcare Innovation. So they're a group at Penn their job is to help improve Penn medicine, all the hospital systems there. They'll help faculty develop their own technologies in-house, and those ones we'll work with as well if it's something that can be spun out into its own company. But also they'll pilot things from other startups and other companies into the system. And a lot of it is all focused on, you want to find a champion within a hospital system, a physician. It likely has some leverage that says, I like this, I want to use this. And, you work with them to get it implemented into that hospital, get a pilot, do all that kind of stuff. And like I said, back to original comment, it's about efficiency.
Yeah, great. Okay, I got one more question to end things with. And that is, and I don't ask this of everybody, but this seems appropriate for you guys, especially being close to a university setting. If there is a recent college grad who is interested in the med device space, but not so much just med device in general, because that's too generic, but specifically in getting into med device startups in a leadership role, not necessarily a CEO, but just leadership in general in a med tech startup, what's the best piece of advice for them to prepare themselves, for a role like that? What do you guys recommend?
I think my advice is mostly probably applicable to master students, PhD students, postdocs who have been doing research in the lab before they're transitioning out. If they're really interested in entrepreneurship, they are really the perfect partners for a PI who is going to stay at the university, and the student can go out and build this company. We've had a number of, Penn students who have done that with our companies and taken on either a CEO role or a lead scientist or engineer role because they're so familiar with the technology. They often are the ones who did the in-lab validation or the verification. So they can kind of see what the development process could be. But within the confines of a startup, it helps to have a CEO who has experience in that, because all of a sudden you're going from this idea of exploring science and exploring the world to, okay, you have to laser focus on what is the next value add for the company? What do you have to prove works in order to make this go? I think students who are just leaving their research and transitioning out, they're sort of in this perfect position to be able to take on that role because they know the technology well up front. The other thing that I would say is we've had, and Mike said this before, the SBIR, STTR program through the NIH and NSF, DOD, all these agencies can help support that new grad taking on what is a pretty big risk for their first step in career.
Right.
Their career. So it's salary to be able to support them so they can try this and see how it goes. And if it goes well, then they get a phase two, they raise money, and they were one of the first employees or the founders of this company.
Yeah, cool. Mike?
Yeah, so if we're talking about a student that wants to join an existing startup company, say if I was the startup company or if I was the CEO in the startup company, I have limited resources. And if I had a need for something, I want someone who knows what they're doing. I'm from academia, I still work for a university, and it's all about training. In a startup, it's not as focused on that because you're just trying to survive. You're trying to stay afloat. And so if I have a job that I need to hire for, I'm looking for someone that knows what they're doing, mm-hmm. That knows how to do that job. So for a student, find out what you're really good at and join and sell yourself from that perspective. Find a company that needs the skills that you already have. You'll join a company, and you know, if most people who are entrepreneurs or want to join startups, they want to do a whole bunch of things. And that's going to happen. You get hired to do development or you get hired to do this, but the company's going to need a million things done out beyond that scope. And so you're going to get that experience and you're going to get to grow. But to get your foot in the door, especially with smaller startups, you have to fill a need for the company.
Okay. Yeah, that's great advice. And actually, I thought we were going to end on that, but I remembered one more thing I'd written down. Maybe what are some current companies that you can kind of talk about if you want to give them a little spotlight here? Now would be a good time to maybe just talk about them if you want.
Sure, Mike, you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. So I already talked about Quantitative Radiology Solutions. We have a company called Varex Health, which is spun out of the lab of Mark Yim, robotics professor, actually. It's a med tech company. They're developing steerable needles for a variety of applications to treat cancer and other things. So that's a very promising company. We've got Paradigm Surgical. They've been all SBIR funding up until now. It's been a lot. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that one's an example of, you know, we talk to investors and they want to see X, Y, and Z first. And, you know, in order to get to X, Y, and Z, we need to get that SBIR funding. And now that we have the SBIR funding, we've been so successful with it that, you know, talking to med tech companies and they're like, you're almost there. So, you know, I always push them to raise money, but they're like, yeah. Oh, we're almost there. So, you know, they're kind of on that, straddling that as well.
Yeah. Cool.
But that company, they're kind of revolutionizing the way to prevent incisional hernias from reoccurring, which is actually a huge issue that I was completely unaware of until, you know, I met the founder, John Fisher.
Okay.
I mean, I can continue listing company after there's a lot of company, you know, if they're all going to watch this, I want to make sure that they all get loved or, you know, involve them. But those are just a couple that I work closely with.
Okay.
How about you?
Yeah, the couple that I would like to highlight, there's a company called NeuroAlert Technologies. They're developing an automated stroke detection system. It's founded by Stephen Messe and James Weimer at Penn. It's amazing. About 10% of hospital strokes go undetected, and it takes about 4.5 hours for hospital staff to detect a stroke when it happens in hospital. So they're developing wristbands that basically detect asymmetry in your motion to be able to alert staff within an hour. So that's a pretty amazing company that's been very rapidly growing. They're part of the NextFab Accelerator from this past cohort. So they're doing really well. The other company is called FlowBio. They're developing a diagnostic system to assess bleeding and thrombotic risk in patients, emergency care patients. You come into the hospital, you don't know why you're having bleeding complications, or you're clotting improperly. This diagnostic test can assess specific drugs in the system, their levels. It's actually, bleeding risk is one of the highest adverse events that happens in an ER. So there's need there. And the company was founded by Scott Diamond. They've also been really successful with their non-dilutive funding strategy, getting grants from the NIH and NSF. So great. Excited to work with both of them.
Yeah, that's great. And so in terms of finding a list of these companies, if listeners just go to the PCI Ventures page and click on portfolio, you could see it based on device, diagnostic, digital health, education, materials, robotics, therapeutics. Very nice. Okay. And they could just find it through there.
Yep. And we'll be releasing every year we have a spotlight on the companies in our portfolio, our services and our partners. So there will be a 2020 spotlight coming out early this spring.
Great. Okay. Awesome. Well, you know, hold on for one second, guys. I'm going to stop the recording and we'll do a quick download. But I really appreciate your time. Again, people can connect with you. Both your names will be directly in the title of the podcast. Feel free to connect with both of them on LinkedIn. You could check out the webpage at PCIVenturesisit.com, or if you just Google PCI Ventures, it'll come up. And you can look through there, but really impressive, what you guys have going on there and even in the greater Philly area. But I really appreciate both your time. I think there's a lot of great insights you gave, a lot of great advice, and really did a good job of describing what PCI Ventures can do for innovators and how they can take advantage of the network you guys have built. So I appreciate it.
Great. Yeah. It's
fun.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you need anything from the podcast, you can always contact us at projectmedtechpodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening and have a great day.